But I think there was a lot more to your success with other than just shows, because, as you said in the beginning of Easy Star, some of the early releases weren't just getting the numbers you needed to start working full time for Easy Star. So financially, it wasn't quite enough rewarding. But I think, I know that Dub Side of the Moon was financially very successful and spent months on the charts. And not many reggae albums can say that, artists or albums as a whole can say that, where they've spent months. There, some of them are happy with just a month, but and most don't even get that.
Look, thank you for the accolades. And honestly, I don't really think about that kind of success very much. It is amazing to think about, I guess. Wow, we spent months on the charts, and it's very gratifying, And we made the writer, we made Pink Floyd a lot of money, so they should be happy for that. But to me, the measure of success, well, two things. One, because of Dub Side of the Moon, as a producer, even outside of Easy Star, I've been able to do a lot of great stuff that I wouldn't necessarily have had that opportunity to do. So I'm very thankful. Obviously, it allowed Easy Star Records to flourish and now grow into the big label. Not I mean, big label. It's still four of us and occasionally an intern, but a label that at least is able to put out quite a few quality releases every year that we really believe in and that we can promote. But the third thing is that, and I touched on this before, is it really did break down a lot of barriers. And people, I've met so many people who've said, Dub Side of the Moon was the first reggae I ever heard, And then they went on to listen to all the classic reggae that I grew up listening to, Or we got comments like when the album first was about to come out and there was some press about it. So there were all these message boards, because back in the days there were message boards for like Pink Floyd fans or rock fans or whatever. And we were getting lambasted without anyone having heard it. People were like, this is sacrilege. This is going to be terrible. Reggae sucks. How could they do this? And after the album came out, we got a lot of comments from Pink Floyd fans saying, you know what? I wanted to hate this, but I really loved it. And now I like reggae. So we converted people into being reggae fans, which to me is the biggest measure of success.
I can't agree with you more with everything that you said as a form of success. Now, I am speaking on behalf of viewers and listeners that don't know the inside gratification of musical success, but they
Sure.
see that it was an album and songs that spent a lot of time in the charts. They can see that. That's something.
Yeah, I get that.
So I have to express that so that these people understand where it's coming from. But I love what you're saying, because for any real musician, that's where the gratification is, and people in the music business. And like you said, your album was sometimes the first album for some people listening to reggae, and you grew the reggae base. You help build a larger army. And I think at the end of the day, any of us in this business, that's what we're all trying to do.
Yeah.
That's the whole reason for this platform, on top of that, for Shockwave. So it's to expose people to stuff they may not know, or help open some doors for some people. So that's really great to hear. Now, with this success, did that in turn contribute to the idea of doing the other tribute albums?
100%. I mean, the second tribute album in the series, Okay Computer by Radiohead, which we did and called Radio Dread, that came about partially because we had heard that on their world tour in, I don't know what year it was, but early, I think maybe 2004 or something like that, or 2005, they were touring. And we had heard anecdotally that before or after their shows, they were playing Dub Side of the Moon on their sound system in the arenas they were playing in. I'm like, wow, do we have some fans in Radiohead? And then we found out that it was because like one of the guys in their crew was a big fan. Like maybe their front of house guy or something, you know? So Radio, we knew that Radiohead knew of us, which was cool. And then again, I wasn't a big Radiohead fan. I probably only knew Creep at that point. I love all music, but I wasn't listening to a lot of rock music, you know, in the 90s, especially or the early 2000s. And so I can't remember, it was either Lem or Eric's idea to look at OK Computer as a possibility. And so the first time I listened to that album, I was like, you gotta be kidding me. Because on that album has 12 songs and 7 of them are either not in 4/4 time at all, or they change time signatures like 13 times in the song, or, you know, it's, I was like, this is pretty far out for reggae. Now, I knew that because on Dub Side of the Moon, Victor and I figured out that if you do something as steppers, you can kind of make odd time signatures work. That's what we did with Money. You know, we weren't quite sure, like, how do we do a song in 7 as reggae? And we came up with a steppers beat that kind of held it all together. It was tricky to learn for all of us, you know, but now that we can do it, we know how to do it. So I figured, all right, there's a way to do weird time signatures in reggae. It was certainly a really interesting, compelling album that a lot of people loved. And then couple that with knowing that Radiohead had some interest in us, we just figured that would be a good second album to do. So that was the reason for that. Then we followed that up with Easy Star's Lonely Hearts Dub Band, our tribute to Sgt. Pepper, which I guess, like, as soon as you start thinking about doing tributes of any kind, the Beatles are always in the ether, you know, because they're just so popular. And I remember listening to the Sgt. Pepper's album as a kid and really loving it. I spent a summer at my aunt's apartment in Tel Aviv, and like, she had this great vinyl collection. And my sister and I was 10 years old, and we just played, like, every day we played Sgt. Pepper's. We probably drove the adults crazy, like, to hear the same thing every single day for a month. But so that album was, like, deeply ingrained in me. So that was a fun one to do. And then we followed up with Michael Jackson's Thriller, which is another album that I loved from being a kid. And that was a nice, for me, you know, I should have touched on this earlier in our conversation. There's a very, very strong relationship between American R&B soul music and reggae. There would be no reggae as we know it without the influence of what was going on in American Black music in the 60s and 70s. So to me, it was like, it made so much sense to do tribute to the biggest artist of all time, also the biggest Black artist of all time. Although I will say, at the risk of maybe pissing some people off, we did get comments from people saying, like, you know, I used to love Easy Star All-Stars, but now that they did Michael Jackson, I'm burning my Easy Star All-Stars CDs. And I do think there was some amount of racism there, which is insane to be a reggae fan and be racist against Black American music. But I really feel that may be the case.
Well, you know, the other thing kind of that crossed my mind thinking about this was, and don't take this any bad way, I'm just putting there and want your feedback. You know, it seems like, and I've heard this, and that's kind of why I'm bringing it up, that, oh, you know, Easy Star kind of sold out, you know, they're taking the easy way out, they're doing Pink Floyd, you know, the tribute albums were kind of an easy way out because their earlier stuff wasn't doing so well. Right. And these tribute albums, what is your response to that?
Okay, well, everyone's entitled to their opinion, but if they heard the story that I'm telling you right now, I think they'd understand that these albums came from, yes, did we want to be successful? Of course. I think every label would like to maintain their musical integrity, which we did, and be successful. So there was some calculation there. What should we choose that could appeal to people? But I can't think of it as selling out. We have brought more people into the reggae fold than than maybe any other reggae label. You know, like most reggae labels exist to service the reggae fan. Mm-hmm. You know, we made reggae fans, you know. True. And, you know, like, you know, an album like Thriller, that's near and dear to my heart for a majority of my life, you know. So it wasn't about, oh, let's sell out, let's do Michael Jackson. You know, if anything, it was, you know, we would have been safer to not do something like Michael Jackson, like I said, because some people were against the idea of us leaving the rock world and going into the black, you know, the R&B world. So I don't take offense at any of that stuff. You know, everyone's entitled to their opinion, but to me, it's about the music. Like, if we made music that people were like, wow, that's cheesy, you know, then that's one thing. But I stand by all the music we've made in terms of being quality reggae. And the fact that all these Jamaican artists want to work with us and do this stuff, I think speaks to that as well.
Yeah. You know, and speaking of Jamaicans, they have a saying, imitation is the greatest form of flattery. So it's your paying tribute to these people that you grew up and learned to love, you know, and with your partners, you know, the Radiohead and the Pink Floyd stuff. So yeah. I just wanted to kind of put that out there because.
Oh, that's great. I love talking about this stuff. And one other point, though, too, is that, you know, if we wanted to make the so-called quick buck, we'd be doing like the greatest hits of so-and-so, you know, like the Eagles' greatest hits. The Eagles' greatest hits, the album, is like the biggest selling album of all time besides Thriller. You know, we would have done that. But right. We do have this sense of integrity that we want to do albums. We want to do albums that make sense together, that whether they're considered a concept album or not, it's an album. It's something that you're going to want to listen to straight through. And the album itself is a journey that it tells a story. It's not a collection of random songs, you know? So that's very important to me as a music fan who still enjoys albums and as the producer and the musical person behind East Star All Stars.
Well, you know, you said that these albums kind of created some opportunities for yourself outside of the label as far as doing production and stuff. What were some of those opportunities? Were any of them in reggae? And what were some of your favorites?
Oh boy. Yeah. I mean, I've worked with a lot of great artists, and a lot of it in reggae, because for better or for worse, people look at me as a reggae producer because of the success of all these Easy Star albums, which is great. It's hard for me to, I mean, every album I've done is special to me in different ways.
So pick two projects that really stand out.
Okay. Well, I did an album I actually produced quite a bit of music in Israel over the last 10 years. I go back and forth a lot, not since the pandemic, unfortunately. And I produced an album there for a group called Ground Heights. That was 2018, maybe 2017. I can't remember now. And it's a really special album to me because musically there's reggae, but there's also R&B. And then there's also Ethiopian music, which I love. The lead singer is Ethiopian Israeli. And then there was the more typical Middle Eastern sounding stuff. There was an influence of funk. There was an influence of rock. It was just all these kinds of music that came together. And to me, that's really appealing because I love all different kinds of music. You know, so I had a great time. And I mean, there were great people too. I'm still, you know, friends with them. And it was really fun to produce it and mix it. And, you know, it doesn't have any, you know, commercial success, but it was very meaningful to me and musically really, really, really fun. So let's see another. Oh, I did an album with an artist named Corey Harris, who's mainly known as a blues artist. I mean, he's very highly acclaimed. He was in when Martin Scorsese did a documentary on the blues, he was featured in it. Really deep guy. And I produced a reggae album for him called Zion Crossroads. That was, I think, 2006 or 2007. Really great stuff, because one of the reasons I got into reggae, as I mentioned before, was the lyrics. And, you know, a lot of Corey's songs were about things that are important to me. You know, he had a song about Walter Rodney, who was a very important figure in in world history, but who, and maybe I heard him mentioned maybe in say like a Steel Pulse song, but Corey did a whole song about Walter Rodney, really educating people about him. So I thought that was great. Yeah, I mean, I'm thankful for every artist I work with, but those are just two of the many that I've enjoyed working with.
Yeah, and that's going to lead me to the one that initially sparked this whole interest, or kind of like created the opportunity to speak with you, because it's something that's new and something that's definitely was very excited when I heard this, that you worked with and produced Jason Mraz's latest album, Looking for the Good. How did that come about?
Yeah, well, so the album is called Look for the Good, although we should be looking for the good actively as well. The album's called Look for the Good. So in 2018, I got contacted by someone from Atlantic Records, which was Jason's label at the time. And they wanted a remix, a reggae remix, you know, the stuff that I do. They wanted me to do it for Jason's single at the time. It was called Have It All.
Yeah.
So I think it came to me pretty quickly. I came up with the rhythm. I recorded the track in my home studio. I overdubbed some horns at another studio. And Jason loved the remix. So I asked my contact Atlantic to put me in touch with Jason. And I know a lot of big pop artists. I mean, for those of you who don't know, Jason Mraz, you know, his song I'm Yours is one of the most popular songs of the last few decades. Yeah. He just recently passed 1 billion streams on Spotify for that song. And that's only Spotify, you know? So it's kind of crazy to think about how big he is as an artist. But I could tell from his emails, he's just a regular, humble, musical guy. So, you know, I said, hey man, he really loved the remix I did, which was very, very humbling. And I said, next time you're in New York, he lives in California. I said, next time you're in New York, let's hang out. So a few months later, he emailed me saying, hey, I'm gonna be in New York next week for some meetings, let's meet up. So I took him to my favorite restaurant in New York, which is an Ethiopian Israeli restaurant in Harlem called Sion Cafe. Me and my they've been open, I don't know how many years they've been open, but my family, we go there whenever we can. And the owner is actually cousins with a friend of mine in Israel. And I'm very, as a sidebar, I'm very interested in Ethiopian culture and particularly in Ethiopian Jewish culture. It's just very fascinating. So I took Jason there. I was waiting outside for him, and I was expecting him to show up in a Escalade or something, you know, being driven by someone from the label, but he just hops out of the subway and, you know, just, I was like, man, that's a cool guy, you know? So anyway, we talked for like, and ate Ethiopian food for like 3.5 hours.
Wow.
And by the end of that, we basically were like, let's do an album together. And the lesson for everyone is you have to make your own opportunities, you know, like who am I, you know, I mean, yes, I have my own career as a producer, songwriter, whatever. And I do get a lot of respect, but you know, it's mostly in the reggae world. So it's kind of like, you know, maybe a little audacious of me to ask a huge pop star, hey, can I produce your next album? But I did it with the confidence that at least the worst that could happen is you could say no, you know? So I hope everyone watching or listening thinks about that, about like asking for what you want, like make your own opportunities. We decided to do it, and then, you know, it took a few months to just work out the details. Then I started writing the arrangements. He had a bunch of songs that he thought maybe could work as reggae. And he also invited me to write new music for him, which is how the song Look for the Good came about. I wrote a track and I titled it Look for the Good, because that's like my personal philosophy, you know, which is, and it comes actually from Jewish scripture, from the book of Proverbs. There's a proverb that says, you know, look for the good and you will find the good. But the corollary to that is if you look for the bad, you're gonna find the bad. So the idea is to look for the good. And actually, learned about this. I was at a synagogue and a rabbi was sermonizing about this. And I remember him, you know, saying, you know, look for the good. That's your choice. Look for the good and you're going to find it. And I thought, that's amazing. And I really kind of took that to be my personal philosophy. So I shared that with Jason, excuse me. And he loved the idea. And then we got a song and an album out of it. So it was great. We recorded the whole album at Jason's home studio on his ranch, on his farm in Southern California. I put together a lot of great reggae players that I knew from just from over the years from Easy Star, but that were based in the LA area. And Jason brought in some of his own players who also were steeped in reggae. And we recorded, the basic tracks were six musicians playing live in the studio, you know, so pretty old school. And then, you know, we did some overdubs and we overdubbed the horns, but even Jason did scratch vocals live. We even had scratch backing vocals live. Like it had a really full sound. And it was a great experience to make music that way. And also to be on his beautiful farm, you know, be able to step outside the studio and just see nature, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was great. And then, you know, I mixed it back in New York, with my friend Scott Jacoby, who's a Grammy-winning mix engineer. And Jason left Atlantic Records and signed a deal with BMG Records. And they're a big, big independent company, but they're really cool because they actually care about the world and about people and about musicians. And they've done a lot of kind of revolutionary stuff in terms of deciding to go back and look at past contracts with musicians, especially African-American musicians who maybe were taken advantage of when that was very common in the 50s and 60s and such. And they're trying to make these contracts better and basically like to take care of artists better than they were taken care of, you know? And to me, that means a lot. They're really, you know, and I've met with a lot of the top people at the label and they're really just good people, you know, so it's nice to see that. And so the album came out, unfortunately, during the pandemic and we couldn't tour behind it. Jason couldn't really do we were going to do the, you know, hey, the whole band is going to play on, you know, the Today Show or whatever. And we couldn't do it, you know, so hopefully we're going to start touring, you know, this summer. It's possible, if not, you know, in the near future.